This is Jill Burridge here with the spring 2025 issue of our quarterly magazine programme, which is produced by Mark. You'll hear some of the most interesting items we've offered over the past few years, something new from Vocal Eyes and our regular suggestions for this week's radio listening. Our first item from 2013 is a conversation I had with Peter White, the longtime presenter of Radio 4's In Touch programme. Hello, this is Jill Burridge, and today I'm in London, actually, in a studio in Broadcasting House. With me is Peter White.
Hi, Jill.
Hello. And your official title is the Disability Affairs Correspondent for the BBC. Is that correct?
I think I can still lay claim to that, yes. And sometimes I call myself the Disability Affairs Specialist.
That's better.
But I rather like correspondent because it takes me back to my early radio listening days when I used to listen to, I was a very odd child, and I used to love From Our Own Correspondent and all those men, mainly men, almost exclusively men, I'm ashamed to say, in rather echoey studios in faraway places.
And have you ever done a piece for From Our Own Correspondent?
I have. It was one of the proudest moments of my life because it's just so fantastic, isn't it, when you achieve one of those ambitions. I've done a few, actually, but the first one I ever did was from when I went to do the Paralympics in Atlanta, which was the first Paralympic. I've done four now, but I did that one, and I rang them up, and you know, it's like ringing your heroes. Yes. I rang them. I was very nervous. I was about 48 at the time, but I was still nervous, and I rang them up and said, would you like a kind of rather offbeat, out of left field piece from our own correspondent from Atlanta on the Paralympics? And they said yes, and I was thrilled to death about it.
As I said earlier, we're sitting in a studio in Broadcasting House Tuesday afternoon. This is your regular time for recording the weekly edition of In Touch.
Absolutely.
Which you have been presenting since the, I think, I'm right in saying, since the 1970s?
74. 1st of March 1974 was the first time I presented it. I did some items for it before then. I was a young blind man trying to batter my way into the BBC.
And how did you do that?
I battered my way into local radio by hitchhiking down to Southampton while I was still at university. And I can remember sitting in my little, you know, those little box-like university rooms that we had in those days. I think they're a bit grander nowadays, but mine was a box. And hearing on a news summary that was going to be a local radio station in Southampton. I wasn't very happy at the time. I was doing law and I wasn't cut out for the law, really. And I'd begun to think, I've got to do something else. And I suppose I've always been complete radio nut. Grew up listening to radio, everything, you know, from foreign stations to From Our Own Correspondent, as I said, to all sorts of things. And I just heard this and something clicked in my head. And I thought, I've got to get in on the ground floor of this. They said the radio station was going to open in December. So I hitchhiked down and I gate crashed, basically. I went in and I didn't get very far with my initial interview, which turned out to be with a receptionist. So it's not surprising I didn't get very far. And somebody saw me leaving the office in my white stick trailing rather dispiritedly into the lift. The guy who saw me had to do a programme for blind people, didn't know any blind people, didn't even have a blind granny. Can you believe it? Everyone's got a blind granny. And he rang me up. I was at home. I was just getting ready to hitchhike back. And he said, come and see me. And this is a very long story, but that's the short version. He said, come and see me. And I thought, I'm going to get my foot in that door and I'm not going to let it out again. And I did a very similar thing with In Touch, which was because by then I'd managed to worm my way into local radio. And I contacted Thina Heschel, who I bet you remember.
I do.
Yeah. And Thina was the producer and she said, come and see me. And same thing happened, really. The first piece I did for her was absolutely appalling. It was dreadful. And bless her heart, she absolutely bawled me out for it. And Salient were the same. I was really lucky. What you often hear is nobody will give me a chance or nobody will take me seriously. Both Salient and Thina both told me off about the first things I did. Salient sent me back to do it again because I hadn't got the levels right. And Thina said it was just a mess, basically. And I'd have to do that again.
So you were doing it. You were recording single-handedly, were you?
Well, what happened when I went to Solent? Yes, I was. You did. I went abroad in the early days. I can remember Thina sending me to Belgium. First time I'd ever been abroad. And I just got sent out with an old Ewer tape recorder, which you will remember.
Weighed a lot.
Reel-to-reel tapes. Weighed a huge amount. And for about the first 20 years of my career, I carried this around on my shoulder. And Thina sent me off with about a box of 20 tapes and a few ideas and a tape recorder. And said, go to Belgium. And so that's what I did, and brought back some stories. So I was doing all my own recording, getting the levels right sometimes, and sometimes not getting the levels right. And Solent was the same. I went off to the New Forest to interview a girl horse rider. And I always remember one of the things about that very first interview, because I said to her, what are the main dangers of horse riding for blind people? And she said, low-flying aircraft. So she obviously wasn't taking me very seriously. And that taught me not to ask stupid questions, really, because obviously the dangers for horse riders are the same as for any other horse riders, really. Just stay on if you possibly can.
Were you able to edit your material?
Well, I tried. We did it.
With razor blades in those days, you know.
Yeah, my tape recorder was a mass of blood, basically, where I cut my fingers. And I mean, I was taught to edit, and I actually came up to London when I knew I was getting somewhere was when they said, would you like to go on a course? And I went, because I'd been doing it about 3 months, and, you know, it must have been with no experience whatsoever. So I went to London and I did this course. I did learn how to do it, but I was never very good at it. I was lucky. I mean, without trying to sound big-headed, I had some talent for it. I seemed to have a voice that was a bit of a radio voice, and I knew how to put pieces. I knew what the story was. And so after a bit, I got to the stage where they would do the editing for me. And I'm very glad. It was very good for me, because I probably would have bled to death otherwise.
I think you did that. But as a presenter, you moved beyond the field of disability, didn't you? You did You and Yours.
That was really important.
You still do.
It was very important for me that. When I first went, I tried to be very sniffy. I was about 21 and said, I don't want to do anything about disability. And I very quickly realised that was a very stupid attitude to take. But remember, I'd been to boarding school. I'd been to blind boarding school. I even had a blind brother. So I couldn't get away from blind people. And when I left, I thought, I want to live in the real world, which is silly because we are part of the real world. But I understand it, and I see it sometimes in young people now. I was very lucky because, of course, disability got very big, actually. Nobody thought much about disability in the 70s, but it became very important politically. The whole, you know, the whole ethos changed, benefits changed, their needs began to be recognised. Then I got in touch, and I suddenly realised that this was something I knew a bit about that other people didn't. And in radio or journalism generally, that's what you need. You need a level of expertise. But yes, then even with Solent, they were very good. They didn't expect me to stick to disability. I used to go and sit in the back in their morning meetings for Solent Today, their magazine programme, and just bid for stories like anybody else and go out and do stories. So when I went to In Touch, Thina was very helpful there, actually, in pointing me out to other producers. You gave me some work, even. When I was disability affairs correspondent, you actually gave me the first job, I think, away from what you might call the straightforward news stuff, because you asked me to do a thing about children's fiction, a programme called Treasure Island.
Yes, that's right.
That was you, wasn't it?
It was indeed, yes, yeah. Presented by Michael Rosen.
Indeed, absolutely. And I did a piece about disability in children. So I was still on disability.
It was a bit, yes.
But then I did increasingly move away. By then I'd grown up a bit, and I realised that doing programmes like In Touch was really important, and that I should do them, and I shouldn't try and say I won't. It wasn't either or. You could do both. And so I did both, and I worked for You and Yours. And, you know, I've done a whole range of things. But Solent, I mean, one of the most exciting things, Solent, after a while, I was presenting their sports programme on a Saturday afternoon with stuff coming from about 40 studios.
I was going to say, that would have been frantic. Gosh.
It was incredibly frantic, but probably, again, a bit like doing From Our Own Correspondent. one of my best moments. The idea of me sitting there giving the, you know, we've got a flash from the Dell, Southampton have gone one up. I love, absolutely loved it. I'd still like to do it. It's a boy's own, really.
You mentioned a moment ago that you went to a boarding school for blind people. So you were born blind, weren't you?
I was, yeah. Non-development of the optic nerve.
And was your brother in a similar situation?
Same thing, and it was no real clear explanation for it. We still don't know completely. There's no history of blindness, and both my brother and I have had children, and they have had children. And it's just an isolated case. Steve Jones, the great geneticist, told me that it must be a father's chromosome. And I never told my dad because he was quite happy not knowing that. They didn't know, and I didn't care. You know, it happened. It was one of those things.
Going away to school as you did, what effect did that have on you?
It's hard to know, isn't it, Jill? I hated it. I mean, I hated going away to school. I went to school, away to school when I was 5 and 3 months. And
was it far away from home?
Yeah, yeah. It was 83 miles away from me. It was Bristol. I was in Hampshire. And my parents had no... This is 1952. My parents had no transport whatsoever. My dad, who'd been a motorcyclist display rider, and he was a dispatch rider in the war, he bought a motorbike so that they could come and see us. And Colin had been there. He's 4 years older than me, my brother, for 4 years. When, you know, it was just a question of if they went down there, they got on about, you know, 3 trains and about 4 buses to get there. And then when there were two of us there, and because I made much more fuss than Colin, I really did. I was sick every morning when I went, and poor old mum took me to the train, and I got onto the train and leant out of the window and held onto her hair. She had to run along the platform, tear herself free of me. If you say what effect did it have on me, you'd have to say, I suppose, in all fairness, that I turned out all right. I got through it okay. In many ways, the two specials, I got a good education, a really good education. I went, the first school was pretty duff, to be absolutely honest. I learnt Braille and I took to Braille like a duck to water. And I passed, there was a secondary school called in Worcester, and I passed that. It was like the 11 plus. And it honestly was the difference between, you know, having just a tiny selection of jobs that you could do and being expected to go to university. It was that big a difference. So
it obviously did give you a good start, despite the fact emotionally being,
I know,
incredibly difficult.
And I know some terrible stories about, you know, I know a lot of people really never quite got it back together with their parents. They blamed them. There were rifts. I'd never felt like that about it. It may have helped me that I had a brother there. I kind of understood that they had to do it. There was no other option in those days. You didn't go to the local school. It wasn't offered. And if people wanted to fight them on it, then suddenly the kid became a cause célèbre, and that's no way to grow up either. All these fights over. It just wasn't on. I think we were just very lucky that they were really good parents, and we never felt, I always felt rooted at home. And I think a lot of my sense of being comfortable in the world does come from them rather than the schools I went to. I think it's just that the schools didn't ruin it completely for me, really.
You've now got 4 children of your own.
Absolutely, I have. Well, three of our own and one we fostered, who we virtually regard as our own, really. It's easier to say we've got 4. So we've got three of ours and one who we long-term fostered.
And are they fairly sort of, I just wonder, because I always remember you asking me what you should say in your speech when you were giving your daughter away at her wedding.
And did I?
Yes, you
that.
Did, yes. I don't think I was any help whatsoever. But
I don't think you were remembering the speech I did give. I seem to remember I very unwisely went to my brother, who gave me some very manly and bad advice, which I took. So, goodness me, I can't remember. You've really taken the wind out of my sails.
Oh,
there.
No. So I was only going to ask, what sort of relationship do you have with them? I mean, really do they sort of have a very frank and open relationship with you?
Absolutely. No, a really good relationship with them. I was always very keen on having kids. That sounds a stupid thing to say, but if either of us were the driving force in having kids in our marriage, it was probably me. My wife would admit this. She didn't, it wasn't that she didn't want kids, but I think I was the one who thought that a marriage wasn't anything without kids in a way. So I really wanted to do that. I think they're all in their 30s and 40s now, and I think I've had a really good relationship with them, and I still see a lot of them. And even when we were, a lot of people thought we were really weird because our kids used to come out with us, you know, quite a lot and socialise with us and go out for a drink. Other cynics said it was only because we bought them the drinks and that's why they went out with us, which may well, there may have been an element of truth in that. But I think we did get on well with them. And I think I established a good relationship with Fiona as well, who was my foster daughter. Indeed, we made a programme together for Radio 4.
Wonderful.
About the relationship, a very honest programme about kind of what we had both expected from the relationship and what had worked and what hadn't.
I'm conscious that time is beating us because we're going to be turned out of this studio.
We are.
And I just wanted to raise something with you, because whenever I've encountered you on the way to work, when I was working at Broadcasting House as well, you would be hurtling up from Oxford Circus Tube Station. You don't have a guide dog.
No.
You go at 80 knots an hour or whatever it is, yeah, and you go zooming across these traffic lights. I mean, you scared the living daylights out of me sometimes, because I would try and catch you up to sort of say, can I help?
So what's the question? Why do I take such risks?
Well, I suppose I'm just intrigued. You don't want a guide dog and never have, do
no,
you?
No, I love, people think it's because I don't like dogs, which is not true. I love dogs. I've got two dogs at home. But I've never been attracted by the idea of having a dog with me the whole time going to work. I think that it's just a distraction. You have to think about it. And I can understand why people do it, because there's probably a greater level of security. I learnt to use a stick from the really early days. I didn't used to be that confident. I have to tell you, it's partly because of this job that I do. Only way I could do it was to be confident and to go out there and to say, yes, I can go to Manchester tomorrow. Yes, I can go to New York on Sunday. Really, it's not, doesn't worry me. So in many ways, I was forced to get more confident. I'm not a natural. My brother is. He's fantastic at getting around. And, you know, blind people are all different from each other. I think with me, it just was, I had to do it. And I obviously have got an element of confidence in me, but actually it's not there all the time. And with radio, I still get nervous. I still wake up. I'm worrying. I wake up at night now and think, oh God, how am I going to get all this done by Christmas? I'm not quite as confident as I appear all the time, but I think I've always realized that you have to have a veneer of confidence to operate in this, both in this world generally and in the world of broadcasting more particularly.
Peter White, thank you very much indeed for having a conversation with me.
Enjoyed it. Thank you, Jim.
Next, a chance to hear the voice of Nick Strudwick again. Nick sadly died a few years ago, but he was one of our editors for over 20 years and would always include news about the fortunes of his beloved St Albans Football Club at the end of his programmes. He was also a singer in the St Albans Bach Choir, but his main occupation in retirement was directing plays at the Abbey Theatre. And he was torn away from working on David Haig's play about Kipling, My Boy Jack, for this Radio Verulam interview in 2014.
Nick, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you very much for coming in. Now, you've made a big sacrifice by coming in at this hour on a Sunday afternoon.
Well, we're in the middle of a matinee performance of the play My Boy Jack, actually.
You are.
But it's not that much of a sacrifice, because this is the third performance and I've been to all the other two and I shall go to the rest of them probably.
Oh, okay. So maybe it's a little bit of a blessed relief.
It could be said to be so.
Yeah. Right. So you just have to make sure that your actors are doing what they ought to be doing in your absence.
And they're left alone. They're well in control.
Excellent. So we're going to be talking a lot about My Boy Jack, which is at the Abbey Theatre, which is running all the way through until this coming Saturday, the 15th of November. Before we do, though, Nick, perhaps you could tell me a little bit about how you discovered your love for the theatre.
Oh, gosh. Well, when I was a teenager, really, I joined a local church youth club, but really because they had a very good drama group. I wasn't particularly interested in ballroom dancing and all the other things they did, but I was attracted by the idea of of doing that, and particularly because one of the ladies that was running the drama bit had been a primary school teacher of mine, of whom I'm very, very fond, and she'd sort of made me interested in drama. And so she also made me very interested in The Wind in the Willows, because I can remember as a small child, we had a Friday afternoon reading from the teacher, and the one I can remember most vividly was The Wind in the Willows, and she used to do rather good imitations, particularly of Mole, as I remember. That was a long time ago.
So it wasn't just reading them, but she was coming up with the voices and giving them more of a dramatic sense.
Yes. She was, her name was Miss Milligan. I never got to call her Marjorie, but that was her name, really.
Oh. So how old were you then when you joined this church?
Oh, I suppose about 13, 14.
Okay. And what are your memories of that?
Well, I can tell you about the first play I was ever in, which
is
slightly embarrassing, but I was 13, I think I was, and it was a play called, why I remember it, I don't know, it was called Safe at Last, and it was a one-act play, and it was about an old colonel, a retired colonel, who was broken into, and the safe was robbed. That's why it's called Safe at Last, I suppose. And I played the part at 13 of a retired colonel, sort of Colonel Blimpish thing. And I remember to the dying day that I started on stage by myself with a whiskey and soda and a copy of the Times in front of me. And disaster on the first night, because maybe I was nervous, I don't know, but I knocked over the glass of whiskey. So I can remember that with great presence of mind. I called for the butler, James. James, I said, come on and clear this up. And
you stayed in character.
Absolutely,
right.
Absolutely, yes. Well, so that sort of set me on the way of whenever I've acted. I haven't acted for a long time now, but I was never really terribly secure in my words, but I never dried up because I always thought of that James and the clearing up the whiskey, and I could get by.
So you could improvise if necessary.
Yeah, not very fair on the other actors on the stage.
No, or indeed on the writer, probably. Which,
no, well, that's true, but they very rarely came to hear it, so they didn't know.
Okay, so that was the Church Youth Club.
Yeah.
And then when did you start to take things a little bit more?
Well, I mean, I did a lot. I lived in Enfield and did quite a few things with an amateur group. Then we moved to St Albans in 1979. And I joined the Company of Ten because friends said it was a very good dramatic company to join, which it is. And I've been with them ever since.
Now, we should probably elaborate a little bit more on the Company of Ten, because I know we've featured a lot of your productions in the past, but people who maybe are listening who aren't familiar with it and its workings.
The Company of Ten, you may think it's got 10 members. Well, it's got a lot more than that. It's probably got about 350 now.
Yeah.
But it was formed, actually, in 1934 by 10 enthusiastic people, one of whom was a man called Terry Newell, who was in fact the father of the film director, Mick Newell. So there's a big family thing there. Now, these 10 people formed the Company of Ten, and this was before I was around, of course, obviously, but they did shows in local church halls. Then eventually, after the next few number of years, they moved to a semi-permanent location at a barn that was on the land owned by one of the members down at the bottom of the Abbey Orchard, south of the cathedral. And they apparently had a fantastic time there. It was a very, very excellent theatre within its confines. But then in the 60s, the land was compulsorily purchased by the local council. I think I've got the facts right, but people who've been
we'll
in longer
than you. You'll
forgive me.
Okay.
Not quite
right.
But anyway, to cut a long story short, they negotiated with the council in the 60s and obtained land on Westminster Lodge, opposite where the leisure centre is now, for the peppercorn rent, which is the thing that you often have to pay not very much for, really. Mm. And by their own hands, almost literally, they built the theatre. They didn't have any funding. They raised it all themselves. And in, I think it was that date right, 1968, I think it was opened by the Queen Mother, who came along. And there are people who remember that day, and with great pride, as you can imagine.
Mm.
And we are fortunate in having our own premises. With it goes the responsibility of the upkeep, of course. We don't get any funding for that, so we have to rely upon our own efforts in getting audiences and, of course, our own subscriptions. But so we are self-contained, we're self-run, and we do generally 10 performances a year. We have a main stage, many of your listeners may know this, but we have a main stage auditorium, which seats 230, and we also have a studio, which is a wonderful place. I love working in the studio. It's a more or less a square box, and it seats 78 people. It's the sort of maximum we can get in there. And we do perhaps more innovative plays there sometimes. And it's a great... We're very lucky to have all that amount of time that we can give. And we also do... We have outside people who come in and use the theatre, for which we get some revenue. That's another help. And we get revenue from our bar, which is... very popular, and all the usual beers and so on, and whatever you might like. So it's a very nice, sociable, friendly place for those that don't know it. and the plays are good too, actually.
Yes, of course. Tell us about your members. I mean, because are some of them professional or none of them professional?
No, none of them professional. No. Everybody's amateur, yeah. Amateur. The only paid member of the theatre is the theatre manager.
Right.
Everybody else, whether they're actors or set builders or whatever, they're all amateurs who give up their own time for it.
And give us an idea of who these people are. Is there a typical...
Typical mix.
Was it a complete mix of...
Complete mix, really. We have we also have a youth group. We call it a company of teens, which is rather corny play on words, you may say. But it is descriptive. They do some very good productions in their own right. In fact, one of the company of teens is in this play that I'm directing at the moment, and another one who recently was. So they feed through. Of course, with young members, very often they then go off to university, and sometimes we lose them, sometimes they come back. But there's quite a throughput of actors. We talk about the actors, but we shouldn't forget the backstage people.
Of course.
I mean, one of the things about this play that's on at the moment is it has got a fantastic set. We're not talking about the play at the moment, but we will in a minute, I expect.
Of course.
But it is a fantastic set, and we are very fortunate because we have a group of mainly retired men, and a couple of women, mostly men, because it's heavy work, really. And they come on every Tuesday morning. They come along and do construction. They're really building the next set for the next play. Then they generally go off to the pub for lunch.
Yes.
And then they come back and do some more work in the afternoon. I don't know whether they do more work when they've had a couple of beers or less work. I wouldn't really know that. But they are wonderful people, and they produce extraordinary things from simple bits of whatever, really. But it's a professional look. I think that our productions are of a standard which lots of professional theatres would be proud to have, actually. Now, that's not me saying it. And so that's sort of a bit of the background.
So what is your background within the Company of Ten? Do you remember what the first production was that you worked on?
Well, I do. It was in 1979, and it was a Christmas show, and it was called The Plotters of Cabbage Patch Corner.
The Plotters of Cabbage Patch Corner.
By the great David Wood, who's written lots and lots of...
Of course, David Wood, who's been on this very programme.
Well, very likely. Yeah, yep. He's great at adapting Roald Dahl stories, for one thing, but also this... particular one was his own invention, and it was a moral story, really, about insects in a garden, the good ones and the bad ones. And I remember I played the Red Admiral butterfly, but I was dressed as a proper Red Admiral, and I grew a beard for it. So I do remember that, yes, that's absolutely something we did.
And so were you in that?
I was in that, yes.
Right,
yeah,
so when did you then turn your hand to directing?
Well, I was in quite a few plays. I suppose I can't remember the first time I directed. It was some years ago now. I think I've directed about 20 plays altogether. Not every year, but the last 5 years I've been very lucky and done pretty well one a year.
And how does that operate? Do you select a play that you'd like to
do? No. What happens briefly in the company, we have an executive committee with each of them with different responsibilities, and there's one person who is responsible for play selection and productions. That's not to say they will make their own decisions on their own. Mm. They could do, technically, but they would always have a group of people around them reading lots of plays and would then come up with a proposal for a season ahead. It needs to be a balanced season. The treasurer will always say he needs two or three bankers who are going to sell really well.
Of course.
And then we're allowed to have to indulge ourselves a bit on one or two of the other ones. And then having done that, we have a group of us who direct, and there are always new ones coming in, who are then invited to pitch in for a play, giving a resume of why they think they should do it. And then they have I call it an interview, it's less of an interview, more than a sort of fairly informal chat with a group of those readers.
Yes.
And at the end of that, they decide on who they're going to ask to direct it. Sometimes, I mean, I did this job myself a few years ago, and sometimes you get maybe four or five directors going for one play. Mm. Another time you just get one, you know, so you can't really tell. And then the director who's been selected gets on with it, really, and you know, has auditions and casts it and gets his backstage people and stage manager all that, and the show's on the road, hopefully.
What's the first thing you do? I mean, obviously you do the research, but then in terms of getting an idea of what kind of production you're going to be mounting, how the rehearsal process is going to work, how do you go about that? Is it just a lot of thinking? Do you have to sit down with an empty sheet of paper? Does it gradually come into your head? What's your way of working?
Well, I always start off with the basic main idea of how I want to see the thing evolve. And then I suppose it is a question of the sheet of paper a bit, you know, and scribbling ideas down. I have fairly clear ideas before I start rehearsing, but the way I work when directing is to allow quite a lot to evolve while you're rehearsing. I mean, I don't think it's a good idea, for me anyway, to start off with terribly set ideas. It's not very... I think it's a bit insulting to the actors apart from anything else. Mm. You have to work together, and I'm very lucky. I've got a fantastic cast of 8 people, who all of whom are highly intelligent actors, very good people, and we've had a fantastic time in seeing how this thing evolves. I mean, you know, we'll spin ideas off each other. I have obviously basic ideas how I want it to work, and we'll work to that, but with independent bits that happen. It's very much a question of evolving it. We started rehearsing for this on the 1st of September, and our normal rehearsal schedule is to have 3 rehearsals a week, and a Monday, Wednesday and Friday, and later on in the process we add a Sunday afternoon. So it's really over a fairly condensed period of time. This was something like 7 weeks from when we first rehearsed. I think that's a good way of doing it. I think you go longer than that, you can get bored and it can get tedious and not very interesting. I wouldn't find it very easy to do that. But I think that way, you're working in a pretty concentrated way, calls on people to give up quite a lot while they're doing it. But they're happy to do it. I'm happy to do it. And hopefully the end result pays off.
So I take it you audition to find your cast?
Yes, we have. We normally have 2 audition evenings, or sometimes a Sunday afternoon, which we publicise through our in-house magazine, and people come along. Sometimes it can be really, really hairy, because perhaps you get your first audition evening and sort of one person turns up. It's not unknown for that to happen. I once, many years ago, several years ago, I directed a play called Abelard and Eloise, which is about the story of the monk Abelard. After 3 auditions, I had neither an Abelard nor an Eloise, which is slightly unsettling.
Yes. But
ended up with 2 fantastic people. So you, if sometimes you have to sort of ring around people and persuade them, come along.
Yes. So you're assembling your cast, and I guess simultaneously you're assembling your production team.
Yeah, well, you do that early on, if you're lucky. I mean, I've got a very, very good stage manager. In fact, 2 stage managers. Both of them are experienced, but they're both very busy people, so they are sharing it. One is very, very good at the administrative side, and the other one is much more technically orientated and can liaise with these Tuesday morning gentlemen that come along and build things, and probably join them for a beer afterwards as well, I expect. So that works very, very well. And then between us, either the stage manager and on their own, or me with them, we'll draw together the other people, the lighting people and the sound and assistant stage managers and so on.
Tell us about the art of directing. There will probably be people listening who may go to the theatre and they can see what the actors do, they can see what the set design has done, they can see what the costume people have done, but they might not be able to put their finger on exactly what you as director have done. What is directing? Is directing all in the casting? Is it in the guiding the actors into finding their interpretation? Is it telling them where to move and when? What is it for you? Is it all of those things, or is it none?
I suppose it's a bit of all of them. I'm not very good at telling them where to move to. I think it's, again, if you've got intelligent actors, that's a bit insulting to them. I think it works. But then, of course, you can see what they can't see. And if somebody's obviously in a bad position where they're blocking somebody else or masking somebody else, you tell them and you discuss, well, don't you think it would be better if you were, you know, behind that chair or sitting on that chair? You know, and they, yes, I think it would be. And so it evolves, quite frankly. I mean, that probably sounds a bit vague, but...
So you're an outside pair of eyes.
Yes, I think that's right. And other directors will probably give you a completely different answer.
Oh, well, that's why I asked the question.
Exactly. I know. But we get together. We read through it. Having cast, we then read the play as a cast, just read it, and then work on it from there. We don't necessarily do it in sequence when we're rehearsing. I mean, for example, with this play, I had one period when 2 of the actors were away for a week and a bit. That's fair enough. I mean, I knew that in advance. So you can schedule your rehearsals around that. But it can happen, and you just have to sort of adapt. I mean, for example, there was one quite tricky scene between 2 people, which is very important. And I set aside a complete hour and a half of the one evening's rehearsal just with those 2, just working on it. And another one where there's one person who has got a very difficult sequence to act out. So she came along and we worked on it for an hour or so together to talk about how she should do it and what I thought, what she thought. I think it's a question of cooperation between cast and director. I don't think, well, I'm not any good at telling people what they have to do. That's, it works. But at the end of the day, if something doesn't look good, that's my responsibility, not to let that happen.
Talk just about the audiences, how easy is it to find your audience? I mean, it's cold, the nights are getting earlier, there's stuff on the telly, there's hot soup at home. You're in competition with professional theatres, you're in competition with all kinds of other reasons why people aren't going to come to see you.
Yep. I would say it's getting more difficult.
Why is that, do you think?
Well, you've partly answered the question yourself. It's partly other attractions, like sitting at home in front of the fire and watching the television or whatever. It's also the fact that people don't seem to... I mean, a bit of a hobby horse, this. People go up to London to see a play, and they pay maybe £40. That's modest at least, some cases, for a ticket. They've got to get up there. They get home late at night. Probably the trains, I believe you suffered from the trains today, you told me, and the trains can be not very friendly to you late at night. And it's a bit of a hassle, and they pay a lot of money. Well, I'm not blowing our trumpet particularly. Well, I suppose I am a bit, really. I think that by common consent, most people say the majority of plays we put on are of a very high standard. And, you know, for whatever it is, £11 or something, you can come along and have a really good night at a very good, very comfortable theatre. Mm. The seats are very, very comfortable, with a good bar, a nice, warm, welcoming atmosphere. I didn't see a play for, I don't know, a fifth of what you would spend going to the West End, no doubt about that. But it's quite difficult to get people away from that.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I really don't know. It's amazing the number of people in St Albans don't even know that the Abbey Theatre exists. A few years ago, I happened to be house managing, because we all do different jobs.
Of course.
I was house managing. And I always, when doing that, I always sort of ask people as they go out, good night. And, you know, if somebody I don't recognise, I might ask them what brought them there. And this lady said, oh, I've come because my brother is in the play. Mm. It's a long while ago. And I said, have you not been before? No, it's the first time I've been. I said, so you come from a long way? No. I live in Prospect Road. Well, people who know St Albans will know that Prospect Road is the road that's right opposite the entrance to Westminster Lodge. Mm. So I said, you've just moved there. No, I've been living there for 15 years, but I didn't know you existed.
Wow.
Now, that's probably partly our fault, maybe. Mm. But I don't know. It's a very difficult question, and it doesn't get any easier. I think at the moment it is quite hard to get. But even so, we will, hopefully, for most productions in the main theatre, we're probably average 70 or 75%, hopefully a bit more.
Which is very good.
But in the studio, we quite often sell out, because that only seats 78 people.
Mm.
So we do quite well, actually, quite honestly.
You do have an audio-described performance.
Yes.
Is that something you normally do for all of your
Well, it's quite a new departure. It's something that I think I'm right in saying, again, there are people that know more about it than I do. They'll probably correct me on this. But I think it was first introduced at Chichester, the theatre in Chichester, a couple of years ago. And what it is, it's audio described for blind or partly sighted people. And the amount of work that's put into preparation for this is unbelievable. I mean, we've got two of our members who did very intensive training with the woman who does the professional thing at other theatres. And they have to come to several rehearsals, and they have to get notes about the play and look at the things they are going to describe
and
the things they're not. You can't describe everything, obviously. So you've got to pick out the important things.
There's obviously dialogue being spoken.
Of course, yeah. I can't imagine doing it. I can't quite understand how they can do it, but it's very successful. I say successful. We don't get a very big take-up of the offer. I mean, I think we'll be doing it next Thursday, and I think at the moment we may have two or three people who have signed up for it, no more. But then they discovered recently that when they went to, I think again it was Chichester, where they did quite a long run, they averaged about two or three for the performances they did as well.
Really?
And that's what so all it's quite difficult is. To get people to come. I suppose if you're a blind person, it must be very difficult to make that jump.
But it's, you know, it's great that the opportunity is there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do work with the St Albans talking newspaper,
yeah,
The Blind,
and I
edit one of their editions,
yes.
And we publicise it on that, obviously.
Of course.
So I publicise it here and say,
yes.
Any people who feel they'd like to, just ring the box office and say we would like to take advantage, and they'll be given a pair of headphones and everything. We'd like to have more people doing it.
Do you have a list of plays after this that you'd like to have the opportunity?
We know the rest of this season. They're all. I can't remember them off my cuff.
Fair enough.
But they're all spoken for. We've just actually the decision has just been made about next season, but I can't divulge that.
Okay. With a lot of plays, it's a question of when the rights become available.
Yeah, that's right. And you can be stopped in your tracks. I mean, a few years ago, we were going to do a Harold Pinter play, and I've forgotten which one it was off the top of my head. But then, we were about 2 weeks into rehearsal, and we were suddenly told we couldn't do it because there was going to be a professional production.
That seems to be a bit unfair after you've even started rehearsing.
Absolutely true. So anyway, I was. That's when I was doing the productions job. And I got on to the publishers and sort of appealed against this because we were doing it in our studio.
Yes.
If we sold every seat, we'd get about 700 people over a week to 10 days. And this was being done somewhere, I don't know where it was. And they agreed and we were... But they actually said, provided you don't advertise the name of the play.
Right. That would be a novel way of advertising.
A very novel way of, yes. Well, we did. We had to do it. They said, you mustn't have anything on the poster. We told people and then it just said... a mystery play is being put on, and we sold out.
How bizarre. Well, maybe that's the answer.
Well, there you are. It could be.
That's the answer. They might have...
I know. We certainly sold out. And, there we go.
Nick Strudwick, it's been an absolutely fascinating hour. Thank you very much for coming in.
Last year, the Grant Museum of Zoology at University College London reopened to the public after a £300,000 improvement programme, including new displays connecting the museum's collections to biodiversity and conservation research. Vocal Eyes have produced an audio guide to the museum, and here's an introduction.
Welcome to this audio-described guide to UCL's Grant Museum of Zoology, which tells a story of the astonishing diversity of life on Earth. The museum explores how the collections and research at UCL have a huge impact on how we understand and learn from the natural world. This understanding is more important than ever, as human actions threaten both the species that share our planet and our own survival. There are 10 main stops. Directions, including 3 additional half stops, give the route through the museum. Just pause the audio between stops. The whole tour should take 30 minutes to listen to. The museum was established in 1828 by Robert Grant as a comparative anatomy teaching collection. It is now home to around 100,000 zoological specimens from every continent, every ocean, and every animal group. This tour describes a selection of specimens, including extinct animals, mammals, amphibians, birds, fish, invertebrates, and microscopic life. The collection is housed in an Edwardian building, and we enter at the corner of a large rectangular room with a floor of polished wood. There's a reception desk to the right. Tall windows let in daylight along 2 adjacent walls, and an upper gallery runs around all 4 sides. It's about 4 metres up, with a further 2 metres to the room's high ceiling. Bespoke, floor-to-ceiling display cases of wood and glass run around the outside walls. More modern freestanding display cases divide the space up into a number of smaller areas. The cases are busily full with skulls, skeletons, fluid-preserved specimens in glass jars, taxidermy, glass and wax animal models, fossils and pinned entomology. Many are displayed in front of a dark blue background. More skeletons look down at us over the ornate metal railings of the gallery, including a chimp, an orangutan and a gorilla.
And here are 2 clips from their audio guide.
Stop 5. Elephants and Rhino.
Elephants and rhinos are not closely related, but face similar threats from habitat loss, habitat fragmentation and poaching. This modern display case contains a number of skulls of infant and fully grown animals, along with other specimens. They are arranged in 3 columns. At the top of the case, to the left, is the skull of a Javan rhino, one of the rarest animals in the world, with fewer than 80 still living. Because they're solitary and secretive, they're difficult to study. It's also one of the smallest species of rhino, the skull measuring around 40 centimetres from front to back. The age-brown skull faces to the left. It has a long lower jaw with a row of large molars. The upper jaw has a toothed section at the back, but the front lifts up and curves over, ending in a point. This raised part would have supported the single horn, with the open space beneath housing the creature's snout. Directly beneath, on a shelf at eye level, is an elephant's molar tooth. Crescent-shaped like a curved horn, this single tooth is almost as long as the rhino's skull above. Its surface is etched by a series of deep ridges, designed to grind up to 160 kilograms of plants per day. Elephants have the biggest teeth in the world and wear through 6 sets of molars in their lifetimes. The centre of the case, an old-fashioned glass display dome around 60 centimetres high and half as wide, is almost filled with an elephant's heart. This real heart has been dried, varnished and painted for study, with blue and red paint highlighting the veins and arteries. Thin paper arrows protrude from the cut-off arteries at the top, labelling the different parts. An elephant heart weighs between 20 and 30 kilograms and beats about 30 times a minute. To the right of the case are 2 adult elephant skulls, one displayed above the other. The upper one belongs to an African forest elephant, the smallest of the 3 living elephant species. Its domed head measures around 80 centimetres high and 40 wide. It has a wide hole in the centre, like 2 circles joined together, which resemble large eye sockets but are actually where the trunk would have been. The main part of the skull is made up of air cavities with a honeycomb design. This reduces the weight of the skull without affecting its structural integrity. The lower part of the skull is elongated as it splits and flares out to each side, providing the sockets for the elephant's tusks. Visible between them, and resembling the front of a shallow boat, is the elephant's lower jaw. It has a pointed, spike-like tip. The Asian elephant's skull beneath is about twice as big. Whereas the African elephant has a rounded skull, the Asian elephant's skull is twin-domed with a pronounced ridge down the centre. 2 curved tusks are displayed at the bottom left of the case, their pointed ends to the left. Tusks are actually teeth, elongated, continuously growing in sizes that protrude well beyond the elephant's mouth. Their surface is yellow with age and polished to a sheen. In the 1900s, the British colonial government in India saw elephants as a resource to be managed for their labour and ivory. At the height of the ivory trade in 1870, nearly 200 tons were sold every year. These tusks belong to the museum's largest elephant skull. Elephants have rich social lives and live in large family groups led by adult females. They experience emotions such as love, anger, compassion and grief. By bringing down trees, digging water holes and spreading their dung, elephants make important changes to the landscape, creating habitats for other animals and plants, and increasing biodiversity. Planning land use to give elephants access to water and migration routes, as well as using natural repellents like beehives, can reduce human-elephant conflict, protecting both species.
To the right of the case, a wide opening leads to the outer corridor. But before we go through, we're going to stop just the other side of the opening, where 4 tall, silver-framed glass cases are attached side by side to the central space wall. Pause the audio until you're there. Stop 7. Sea anemones and corals.
On a chest-high shelf are some wax models of sea anemones. They were made by Maison Tremond, a 19th-century Parisian studio, and are displayed inside a glass dome. There are 3 different species. 2 are quite similar, with thick, amorphous pedestals attached to a rock and disc-like tops, some 10 centimetres wide. These discs have rings of tendrils around the edge and a circular mouth at the centre. One is a grey-blue colour with long, slim tendrils. The other is a translucent, creamy yellow, with 3 concentric rings of short, stubby tentacles and a more pronounced, puckered mouth. The 3rd example is more graceful and lays down across the rock with a slender, yellow stem, like a baby-ribbed squash. A purple collar near its tip sprouts long, blue, finger-like tendrils, which wave as though being wafted by water. The stinging tentacles around a sea anemone mouth are used to catch prey. They're closely related to corals, but solitary. On the lower shelf, close to floor level, are different types of coral. Coral reefs are some of the most diverse places on Earth. The reef structures are built by thousands of tiny individual coral animals called polyps, that form colonies working together as if they were a single animal. Corals can take many forms: flat, rounded, branching or brain-like, creating entire ecosystems on which other organisms rely. And although corals might look like plants, they are carnivorous animals. To the left is an example of a soft coral or alcyonacea. It's pink, flat and fan-shaped and measures some 30 centimetres from top to bottom. It resembles a large leaf with a stem from which veins divide and subdivide. The main body of the coral has a delicate, lace-like structure. To the extreme right of the case is a hard coral or scleractinia, about 30 centimetres wide. Built of calcium carbonate, the coral has a rounded, rock-like form. Its cream-coloured surface is formed by a maze of squiggled lines, like crazily piped icing, between which is a delicately pierced net-like structure. Coral reefs sustain 30% of all ocean species, and their degradation represents a stark reminder of the climate crisis. Their extreme complexity has made it difficult to understand how best to protect them, but modern technologies such as 3D mapping, acoustic monitoring and selective breeding are dramatically improving the prospects of successful reef conservation. Bioacoustics recordings of coral reef sounds such as these allow UCL researchers to hear reef health from the inside, track activity at night, and survey reefs in deep and murky waters. UCL scientists can then use AI to automatically process thousands of hours of audio to build new understanding of coral reef ecosystems.
With the corals to our right, continue along the outer corridor to the corner. We pass a number of high windows on our left. Turn right at the corner and continue for another 4 to 5 metres. We come to a tall glass case. It's on our left and built into the wall display. Pause the audio until you're there.
Vocalise is a charity funded by Arts Council England. And to find out more about our work, do visit www.vocalise.co.uk.
One of the greatest frustrations for anyone with serious sight loss is the inability to just pick up something like a newspaper or a book and read it. That's why the talking newspaper idea was born. It's also why we started to bring you discussions about audio books or talking books. Here's a discussion Rob had with Jane Williams about 4 such books.
Hello, this is Rob Piam, and I'm delighted to welcome to the studio today Jane Williams, another of our senior library staff from the Mid-Hearts.
Yes, that's right, Mid-Hearts. Yeah, I'm based at Welling Garden City, but I do cover the whole of Mid-Hertfordshire, along with my colleagues.
And your job, as with the others that we've had with us, is to select the stock that goes into the library.
We do some of the selection of stock, but we also, our responsibility is stock and reader development. So we look after the stock and presentation of the stock and how it's displayed, but we also are responsible for reader development. So we try and do this sort of work, sort of outreach work, where we are sort of trying to encourage people and enhance people's reading.
Good, let's get on, because the aim is to cover 4 publications, 4 audiobooks, and you've chosen 4 for us this session.
I have indeed.
You've started with a name that's, I'm sure, well known to many of our listeners, Joanna Trollope, and you've chosen her latest, Balancing Act is her latest novel.
It is, yes, it's the latest novel by Joanna Trollope. I've tried to pick a mixture of genre, really, for people today. I picked Joanna Trollope because she does tend to write stories that are very much family stories. They're very much look at the relationships between family members and the complexities that, you know, families have. Balancing Act is very much on those lines. I've read a lot of Joanna Trollope in the past and really enjoy them. This one centres around a character called Susie Moran. Susie is a success. She's founded her own highly profitable company. She's got 3 daughters, all grown up, largely brought up by their father, because Susie put so much into the business. Susie's very driven.
This is the balancing act then between the business and the family.
Exactly, yeah, okay. Yes. So she's balancing her business against her family. And her business has been successful, but sometimes, you know, the family have suffered through this. Although she doesn't realise they have until they are grown up. And this is when it all comes to a head, really. This book starts when the girls are all grown up, all working for the business, living very closely, really, together because they all work for the same business. And in the book, Susie's father, who has been absent through her growing up. Susie was brought up by her grandparents and her father is absent since she was a baby. He appears and he seems to be the trigger that triggers the resentment in the family. It's a very good book. If you enjoy studying relationships, you'll find things that you recognise in this. Definitely. No families are perfect and we can all recognise the things that happen. There's some sibling rivalry going on, although largely the siblings do get on well. But Maurice is Susie's father, and him turning up really does change the whole relationship.
Yeah. So he's been absent and she is presumably got some residual anger about that. And yet she sees, probably, I assume, because I have to admit I haven't read this one, that she in fact has played a similar sort of role. She's been absent from her.
Exactly. And her daughters too, that, you know, when Maurice first turns up, her daughter's not really sure how to tackle it. He's a grandfather they don't know, and they've all got different opinions on, you know, how, what part he should play in the family. And I don't want to give too much of the story away, but he, you know, his presence there certainly makes the family look at themselves and make some changes. And it is interesting. It's a very interesting book. I have picked an excerpt from it, and in the excerpt, it's Susie talking while her husband Jasper sleeps, and it does really begin to show the flaws in the relationship and that Susie's recognising as flaws in their relationship.
Okay, well, let's listen to that extract now.
Jasper was asleep. He was lying on his side with his back to Susie in his usual sleeping position, and his breathing was quiet and even, in a way that was almost impossible to achieve if you were only pretending. But then, if he was pretending, Susie thought, it was because he didn't want to talk anymore. He was tired of what she wanted to talk about. So, asleep, or really awake, it was clear that he was of no use to her. Nor was it any use to be lying awake in the dark, going round in mental circles. It would, surely, be more profitable to get up and go downstairs and attempt to comfort herself with the soothing ritual of tea-making. Proper tea leaves in a proper pot, rather than lie in a tangle of thoughts and creases under a duvet, which was alternately too hot or not warm enough. Jasper's imperturbable capacity to sleep through life's turbulences had been infinitely comforting and instructive at the beginning of their relationship. Now it was beyond mere irritation, and was a symbol of his increasing detachment from everything that concerned her. His languid humour had been irresistible to her once. So sophisticated, so darkly witty. Now it just seemed, too often, to be merely childish. Tiresome evidence of his inability to take life seriously, to see what had to be done, day after day, just to make things work. Well, she thought, turning away from him onto her left side for the umpteenth time, it was no good finding fault with every useless man in her life right now. No use deploring them for their shortcomings. In fact, uncomfortable though it might be to think about, was there something similar in Jasper and Maurice? Was there something in her father's deeply flexible, to put it politely, approach to life that she had unconsciously chosen to replicate in her marriage? And what about her role in whatever had gone wrong in either the past or the present? Her father had never come to find her, but then she had never been out to find him either. Or her poor little mother, because it was always easier to stay where she was, safe and admired and encouraged, and where, above all, the action was.
Okay, so we start to get some sense there from that extract of the relationships which you've been describing in the book. And in fact, I mean, the reviewers were very strong on her intelligence, her clear-eyed sympathy. I'm quoting here from the Times, and they describe it as a terrific novel, always believable, to be relished. And the Sunday Times said she's an extremely assured writer. She's, of course, a very successful writer. I mean, she's written something like 17 novels that have been in her own name, and she writes under another name as well, which I can't quite... Carolyn Harvey... is also her.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
I don't know why she had two names, but no, there we are. She's written some historical novels. She's also written an update, if you like, of Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility. They're trying to rewrite Jane Austen. Yeah. I haven't quite worked out why yet, because the original's so good.
Absolutely. But no, I mean, I've read a lot of her stories, and I thoroughly enjoy them. There was I think it's The Soldier's Wife.
There was one called The Soldier's Wife.
The Soldier's Wife was, I think it was the last book, and that was a very good book as well, and that's another one I'd recommend.
Yeah, that was 2012, so that's just 2 years ago.
Yeah, she did a lot of research into that book and spoke to servicemen's wives and, you know, how they felt when their husbands were away for months on end and then came back. So it was another one that is, the previous one, very different from this, but I think she does a lot of research into her books. In this one, actually, she talks a lot about the pottery, because it's a pottery business that Susie runs.
That's right, it's based in Stoke-on-Trent, where the potteries.
Yeah, and basically she really brings it up to date, you know, makes it sort of, the impression that comes over to me is sort of shabby chic type pottery, and she goes into quite a lot of detail, the manufacturing and things like that, which is quite interesting.
Okay, so let's go to your second choice, which is by a writer that I had not come across until about 6 months ago, when somebody, a friend of mine, recommended that I read a particular novel of his called Pure, which is his most recent. You chose one by Andrew Miller called Oxygen. He's English, again. He was actually grew up in the West Country. This is also, in a sense, it is about a family, but in a very different way, isn't it? Because they're very clearly established characters that almost speak through for themselves.
Yeah, there's a small number of characters, really, in this book. I chose this one because it's read by Gordon Griffin, who's quite a well-known narrator of books. Gordon has in the past been kind enough to do events for us at Hertfordshire Libraries, where he's come to talk about the whole process of making talking books and kindly read for us. Gordon read this book, and he also read a couple of extracts from it for us at our last event. So I thought, oh, this sounds quite interesting. I'll give this one a try. It's basically based in the summer of 1997, and four characters in it, reach a bit of a turning point in their life. Alice Valentine, who she's very ill, and she's in a West Country home. She's got two sons. One is still searching for a sense of direction, and the other is fighting to keep his acting career and marriage afloat. And then there's another person that comes into it called Laszlo Lazar, who leads a comfortable life in Paris, and yet he's plagued by memories of the 1956 Hungarian uprising. For each, the time has come to assess what matters in life, and all will be forced to take part in an act of liberation, though not necessarily the one foreseen. Laszlo sort of links in a little bit more as well, because Alec,
son of the two sons, and he's the one who hasn't found where he's going yet.
Exactly. But he's translating actually Laszlo's books for him. So that's the link there. The theme of oxygen runs right through the book in different ways. Both Alice and Ella, who is Alec's daughter, have difficulty breathing. When they have Alice through her illness and Ella through asthma. So their fight for oxygen to stay alive there. But it has lots of other mentions within the book in different ways. And the extract that I've picked actually I think represents that. And Larry is flying home from America.
Because his acting career has mainly been in America. Yes. That's why he's coming back. So he's been away from home. He's coming back.
Yeah, he's coming back because Alice is very poorly, and he's flying home. He's bringing his daughter Ella with him. He's on the plane flying home, and the extract starts there. Alec is going to meet him at the other end. But I think that represents the theme of oxygen running through the book, which is quite interesting. Okay. But it's beautifully read. Gordon does give... He tries not to put too much personalisation into the characters, so that you're able to build up your own picture of them, which is difficult to do, I think, in a talking book. But he does it very, very well. But he lets enough be seen that as a different person talks, you understand that it is a different character. Because this one does jump around a little bit from one character's version of events to another's. So.
Okay, well, let's hear that extract and then we can chat a bit more about it.
There was a rumour, perhaps true, perhaps no more than a high-altitude urban myth, that passengers in economy received less of the piped oxygen than those in superior classes. Larry could not remember who had suggested this to him. It might even have been Ranch. But coming round from the slough of another mid-flight doze, he was inclined to think the rumour had substance, for in happier days He had travelled on the other side of the mysterious curtain, and thought he had indeed inhaled a richer mix, and been the better for it, pinker and more optimistic. He knuckled his eyes and looked round for Ella, but her place beside him was empty. Nor, turning and twisting in his seat, could he see her in the aisles. They had been allotted the middle two seats of four in the central section, just to the rear of the wings. At one end of the row was an American college student, on his way to summer school in Oxford, a young man with troubled skin who addressed Larry as Sir. On the other side was a nun, an ethnic Oriental, who had crossed herself and prayed audibly during the takeoff from San Francisco, for which Larry had been grateful. Like most people, he had only the haziest idea of how this communal defiance of gravity actually worked, and believed that at least one person on the plane needed to offer up a prayer if they were to arrive in safety.
Okay, well, as you say, it's quite interesting because there are the four, and there are four principal characters. There are obviously some minor characters and some relations, like the daughter you mentioned. And the book doesn't sort of address, isn't divided into four parts where each of them is addressing the audience. So it's a mix. It's you have to follow it reasonably carefully. But I think the voice, as you say, will help help the listener to follow that through.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it is particularly beautifully read. Andrew Miller, he does give remarkable details of all the characters and the surroundings too. The scene is perfectly set every time. He describes details so eloquently that in your mind, the scene is perfectly set. And I enjoyed the sensitive unravelling of the characters
in
it.
Yes. I mean, there's quite a lot of distress in their appearances, and I mean, obviously, one of them is seriously ill, and the other two are distressed for various reasons. And the fourth character, the Hungarian who's living in Paris, comes out of a very difficult background, as it were, been through some awful events, filled him with guilt about various things we won't talk about. But it's quite a distressed.
It is. It's not a cheery read, but it's an interesting read. Yes. I think.
I agree.
And you know, illness and bereavement are things that everybody really has just, you know, cope with in their lifetime, and so it is quite interesting to see the.
And Andrew Miller for me is, I mean, as I said, it was a discovery. I hadn't heard of him before. I hit my ignorance, but certainly I'm going to be looking at some others of his, because I really enjoyed his most recent one, Pure, which is most bizarre, about the clearance of a cemetery in Paris in the 18th century. It's actually all an image of the soon to come French Revolution, but we're not talking about that book, but he as a writer does a lot of research. He knows his air, and he's
good. I haven't actually read Pure, but listen to you there, and certainly. I think that'll be one I'll be picking up. This is the first one I'd read.
I hope it'll come out as an audiobook in due course.
They often do, but sadly I think it's less than 3% of books that are published in talking book form. It's quite a small amount, but a popular one like that I would expect it to be.
Okay, so let's go on to your third choice, which is non-fiction, and it's called It's All About Trio. I looked at it and thought, crikey, I'm not sure about this one, because I don't know a great deal about the army, and it is about a bomb disposal guy and his dog and their relationship, but actually it's quite charming.
It is, and I chose this one because I wanted to choose a non-fiction book, and so I went to see what was on the shelf that day, and that was the one that I thought, I quite fancy this, I'll have a little look at this one. Anyway, so I took this one. It's written by Dave Hayhoe, and he is the handler of the dog. And when Dave Hayhoe was sent to Afghanistan to help detect the Taliban's murderous roadside bombs, he knew he'd need a special dog by his side. Luckily for him, his closest pal Trio, a staggeringly brave ball of energy and mischief, was with him every step of the way.
What's amazing is that the reason that the dogs are used for this, and I hadn't grasped this, is that a dog has an enormously enhanced sense of smell. It's done like 6,000 times the human ability, if I remember correctly. It's a massive multiple, which is why they can sniff out these bombs. There are certain traces that they pick up.
There is, and also it's the other senses too, because there's things about people's behaviour that they're picking up as well. So it's not just the sort of sense, but the sense of what's going on around them, and amazing. But the relationship between them is very, very touching. Again, it's going back to the reader, it's beautifully read by Malcolm Hamilton. Malcolm Hamilton's voice, for me was what I would imagine Dave Hayhoe's voice to be. So for me, it was very, very believable that Dave Hayhoe was telling me the story. What's interesting in this one is you have got what's happening with the, you know, with the army in Afghanistan. So it sort of educates you in that way. But you've also got, as well as the relationship between man and dog, quite a bit about the training and, you know, how the dogs work and the different types of working dogs. Because even in Afghanistan, they've got two or three different types of working dogs that do very, very different jobs. But I found the training side and that side very, very good. But what was touching was that although Trio is very, very much a working dog, was that he still, you know, Dave still calls himself daddy to the dog, you know, just as we would with our, you know, pet dogs or cats at home. So that I find quite touching and, you know, called his paws his pauses and things like that.
I mean, it's very much a human story. I mean, it doesn't, it's not a discussion of the rights and wrongs of the Afghanistan war. It's just, here's a man with his dog in a situation and he's trained, they are trained to do certain things, which they do remarkably well. I mean, it's very poignant in places, it's very sad, it's very uplifting, it's the mix of all the emotions, but it certainly is, covers the subject very well. And I was astonished. I mean, I think you're bound to fall in love with the dog.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Although the subject matter, you know, it's obviously, it's sometimes hard to listen to, but other times it's also uplifting. And definitely, it's a book, I think, that will make you laugh and cry, really. It's not... Or, you know, a completely sad book.
OK, and you've picked an extract from quite early on in the...
I have. I've picked at the very beginning, actually, because one thing that struck me with this one was how quickly I was into the story. And this is at the very beginning, and Dave and Trio are in a helicopter just about to land down in Afghanistan.
Let's hear the extract.
Chapter 1. I glance at Trio. I'm worried about how he's coping with the suffocating heat and the thudding beat of the Waka Waka. Its giant twin rotor blades are screaming above our heads as we swoop earthwards, the helo coming in low and fast and weaving this way and that in an effort to avoid enemy fire. I'm sitting on a fold-down canvas seat to one side of the giant helicopter's hold, Trio facing forwards and sandwiched between my knees. The rear ramp's already been lowered, so my dog and I can dive off it as soon as the aircraft hits the dirt. The wind is rushing in like a howling gale, mixed with the heady scent of burning avgas from the aircraft's twin turbines. Trio's a handsome as hell black Labrador Spaniel cross, and he's my most trusted friend. In the world of war dogs, he's known as a toughie and a troublemaker, not a licky, soppy kind of mutt. But right now, I can tell that he's in need of some real comfort from his dad. He feels my gaze upon him and cranes his head around in an effort to make eye contact. The whites of his eyes flash this way and that as he searches for me, his shiny black muzzle pointing vertically at the roof above. I reach down and get my arm around his neck, pulling him in until his head's leant to one side and cradled on my thigh. I hold him close and whisper into his velvety soft ear. It's okay, lad. Dad's here, and he's not going to let anything happen to you. Not ever. But as I say those words, I pray that I've got the power to deliver on them, that I truly can bring my dog out of this one uninjured and alive. When dog and handler are as close as Trio and me, emotions run up leash and down again. He knows I'm excited to be here, but that I'm hugely apprehensive and nervous for him. He throws me this glance, his coal-bright amber eyes like pools of trusting fire. Over the years we've spent together, I've learnt to read his every look. This one says, "Wherever the hell it is you're taking me, Dad, I'm sticking by your side. And as long as I'm with you, I know it's going to be all right." I tell him that it is. I tell him that he's right. I tell him that I'll protect him with my very life if I have to. No one's going to shoot or blow up my best buddy, my dog.
Your fourth book is called Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn. Again, new to me. When I saw that it was a sort of suspense murder mystery, I thought, oh, I don't like suspense. I'm not a great reader of such things, and it's terrible because I know they're immensely popular. I have to say, it took about one chat to me to think, crikey, this is different. This is a psychological thriller. This is par excellence. I mean, I think it's absolutely superb, a wonderful piece of work.
It is. It's actually, it was published last year in the book form, and then the talking book came out last year as well. This one has been picked up by reading groups to discuss because it's a very, very clever book. It centres around a character called Nick Dunn, who comes home one day from work to find that his wife has gone, disappeared. And it tells two stories through the book. It tells Nick's story and Amy's story. The talking book is cleverly read because unusually they've actually got two readers, Julia Whelan reading the female side and Kirby Hayborn reading the male side. And you do straight away begin to pick up on the personalities of Nick and Amy when you start listening to the book, because their voices really do put across their characters. Well, I certainly felt they did. I will warn people, don't expect to like Amy and Nick because they're not nice people, but the book is fascinating. I don't want to spoil it for people, so I don't want to give too much away. It's one of those ones that if I tell you too much, we're going to give too much away, but it's very cleverly written. There is lots going on in there. There's lots of twists and turns. Mm. So right through the book, you might think you know what's going on, but really, I don't think you will. Very clever novel. Definitely I would want to read more by Gillian Flynn.
She's actually not written that much. She was an entertainment journalist, I think. She used to work for the Entertainment Weekly, an American magazine. But so she's only written two other novels before this, one called Sharp Objects, another called Dark Places, which I'm going to go looking for.
Yeah.
Although Gone Girl is the best-selling one that she's produced, and it's been very, very popular.
It has. Not just
in America, which is where it came out, but elsewhere.
Well, I've certainly recommended it to lots of people, and I think most people have really enjoyed it.
It's a very clever construction because after a while, you assume that Nick is the narrator, and then you realise chapter two is sort of narrated by Amy,
yes,
and then chapter three. And so it alternates all the way through, and you've got two narrators, which is a trick that's been played before, but very successfully here. What you begin to realise is that you don't know who's telling the truth, whether either of them are telling the truth, whether this is fantasy that they're building up in their own minds, and it's just very well, and yet there's a lot of depth to it. It's not superficial.
No, it's not, and they're very strange characters, both of them.
I sort of think by the time I got, well, I won't say by the time I got to the end, but as I went through it, that I hated both of them.
Definitely. That's why I said don't expect to like them, because I don't think many people will.
it's not a sort of comfortable Sunday afternoon, sit down and read it. But it's very rewarding if you like good writing, if you like a challenge.
It is. It's clever, and the language is strong in there, but it gets hidden because the story is so good, I think.
That's right. And this, in a way, this Gillian Flynn book, Gone Girl, is in a psychologically extreme situation. So inevitably, some of the demands are made upon how you express what you're trying to communicate are such that it's quite harsh.
And it can sound worse, when you hear it. The excerpt that I've picked for this one, Amy has gone missing and they've set up a volunteer centre in the town for people to come to volunteer to help find Amy. Nick has just turned up at the volunteer centre and he overhears some conversations.
Nick Dunn. 3 days gone. The police weren't going to find Amy unless someone wanted her found. That much was clear. Everything green and brown had been searched. Miles of the muddy Mississippi River, all the trails and hiking paths, our sad collection of patchy woods. If she were alive, someone would need to return her. If she were dead, nature would have to give her up. It was a palpable truth, like a sour taste on the tongue tip. I arrived at the volunteer center and realized everyone else knew this too. There was a listlessness, a defeat that hung over the place. I wandered aimlessly over to the pastries station and tried to convince myself to eat something. Danish. I'd come to believe there was no food more depressing than Danish, a pastry that seemed stale upon arrival. I still say it's the river, one volunteer was saying to his buddy, both of them picking through the pastries with dirty fingers. Right behind the guy's house. What easier way? She would have turned up in an eddy by now. A lock, something. Not if she's been cut. Chop off the legs, the arms. The body can shoot all the way to the Gulf. Tunica, at least. I turned away before they noticed me.
One of the influences that Gillian Flynn acknowledges in her own writing is a play by Edward Albee called Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which was made into a film in the 1960s, and it's about the relationship between two people who've committed to each other. And Nick and Amy, this is their fifth year of, their fifth anniversary has just passed or something. So they're in a relationship, and it's about, it's in a way about that relationship, and it's, I don't want to say too much about it, but thank you for introducing me to it. I very much enjoyed it. Well, that's four books, and I'll just give those names back in reverse order. We've just been talking about Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl, which is read by Julia Whelan and Kirby Hayborn. Before that, we talked about the non-fiction. It's all about Trio, and its subtitle is Life, Love and War with the World's Bravest Dog. And it is a lovely picture of the dog on the front and a lovely dog. And that's by Dave Hayhoe, narrated by Malcolm Hamilton. Before that, we discussed Andrew Miller's Oxygen, which is narrated by Gordon Griffin. And we began with Joanna Trollope's latest, which is called Balancing Act. So those are the four. Thank you very much, Jane, for coming in. Thank you for taking the time out from your busy work at the library.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
Now our selection of national radio programmes that you might like to listen to this week.
Hello, I'm David and I'm bringing you some radio highlights for this coming week that I hope you will enjoy listening to in the days ahead. First of all, Saturday the 19th of April, the Classic FM Hall of Fame Countdown. Classic FM continues its 29th annual four-day Easter weekend top 300 classical chart. On air today, tomorrow and on Monday, revealing listeners' choices of the most popular classical music. You can listen to the Classic FM Hall of Fame Countdown anytime between 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. over the next 3 days, reaching number one by 9 p.m. on Monday. The Passion in Plants. Writer and naturalist Bob Gilbert goes on an Easter pilgrimage, tracing the traditional associations of British wildflowers with the events of Christ's Passion. You can listen to The Passion in Plants on BBC Radio 4 Extra at 7:30 a.m, 12:30 p.m, or at 6:30 p.m. Curious Cases, an episode entitled Invisibility Quest. Hannah Fry and Dara O'Brien search the universe for invisible things. They discover what the galaxy looks like viewed through the infrared, revealing gigantic loops and whirls of dust and gas otherwise invisible. Curious Cases is on Radio 4 at 10 a.m. Beyond Our Ken, an episode from the comedy sketch show from 1959, starring Kenneth Horne, Kenneth Williams, Hugh Paddick, Betty Marsden and Bill Pertwee. You can listen to Beyond Our Ken on Radio 4 Extra at 2:30 p.m. And then a drama, The Fever. Cate Blanchett stars in the one-woman stage play, where a woman suffering from a sense of disconnection from her privileged life chooses to travel to a Civil War-torn country. Cate Blanchett in the drama The Fever is on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. Archive on 4, Masters of the Impossible. Psychologist and magician Professor Richard Wiseman explores the strange world of mentalism or mind magic. Masters of the Impossible is on Radio 4 at 8 p.m. And now for Sunday, the 20th of April, Easter Day. If you're awake early, you can join Radio 4 listeners with a sunrise service from Lindisfarne and Durham with the Easter hymn, Jesus Christ is Risen Today. The sunrise service is on Radio 4 at 6:35 a.m. Or if you'd prefer a slightly longer lie-in, the Easter Sunday worship from Canterbury Cathedral with the Bishop of Dover preaching an Easter message of hope and resurrection. This live Easter service is at 8:10 this morning on Radio 4. The Reunion 1995's Pride and Prejudice. Kirsty Wark reunites the cast and team of the 1995 BBC TV adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. They reflect on how the series offered escapism from the drabness of the country's economic woes. The reunion is on Radio 4 at 10 a.m. Private Passions. Michael Berkeley welcomes actor Romola Garai, discovering her widely ranging music tastes. Private Passions can be found on Radio 3 at midday. And then a drama, Casino Royale, an adaptation for Radio 4 of the first James Bond novel by Ian Fleming. You can listen to the action on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. Sunday feature, Troubadour of the Caucasus. Lucy Ash explores the life and legacy of experimental Soviet-era filmmaker Sergei Parajanov, who once declared, "I am an Armenian born in Georgia, incarcerated in Russian prison for being a Ukrainian nationalist." You can find Sunday feature on Radio 3 at 7:15 p.m. And then Robben Island's Hallelujah, the story of a performance by an achy strong choir of political prisoners in South Africa's Robben Island prison, of Handel's Hallelujah Chorus. Robben Island's Hallelujah is at 7:15 p.m. on Radio 4. And now for some programmes that are broadcast each weekday at the same time. The essay, Erland Cooper's Mythic Mountains. The composer takes five imaginary journeys to mystic mountains around the world. Erland Cooper's Mythic Mountains can be heard each day this week at 9:45 a.m. Conflict and Cooperation, A History of Trade. Paul Seabright begins his series exploring historical aspects of the development of trade. This can be heard each day at 11:45 a.m. on Radio 4. And then Like and Subscribe, How YouTube Changed the World. This story of a screen revolution can be heard each day at 1:45 p.m. Book at Bedtime, One Came Back. The remaining five episodes of the book by Rose Madonna are on Radio 4 at 10:45 p.m. each evening. And Composer of the Week on Radio 3 is Giuseppe Verdi. Four episodes from a Verdi Spotlight first broadcast in 2022 at 4 p.m. each day starting on Tuesday. And then programmes on Easter Monday, the 21st of April. Start the Week, The Role of the Church, a discussion on what is to be made of the Church of England in an age of declining congregations and the profound and ongoing impact of Christianity on the English society and laws. Start the Week is at 9 a.m. on Radio 4. Record Review of the Century, an extended daytime special showcasing some of the finest classical recordings of the last 25 years. This all-day broadcast on Radio 3 starts at 9:30 and continues until 7 p.m. Steptoe and Son, an episode from 1966 of the classic sitcom, is on Radio 4 Extra at 6:30 p.m. Then the Classic FM Hall of Fame finale, the final stretch of the top 300 as voted for by listeners, continues from 9 a.m. on Classic FM, with the top selection being revealed just before 9 p.m. Tuesday, the 22nd of April, drama He Gave Me a Takeaway. Sarah Daniels' exploration of how young women survivors of grooming gangs move forward with their lives. He Gave Me a Takeaway is on Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. To the Manor Born, Penelope Keith stars in the 1997 radio version of this classic sitcom at midday on Radio 4 Extra, repeated at 6 p.m. The Goon Show, an episode from 1957 of this vintage comedy classic. Radio 4 Extra at 6:30 p.m. immediately following To the Manor Born. And then something specially for people with sight loss, a programme called People Fixing the World. Exciting new developments to help people with sight loss, presented by Emma Tracy, the blind journalist. You can listen on the BBC World Service at 8:05 a.m, repeated at both 3:05 p.m. and 10:05 p.m. And then Wednesday, the 23rd of April, Some Like It Hot. Cleo Lane looks at the golden age of all-girls swing bands. From 1999, Cleo Lane can be heard on Radio 4 Extra at 10 a.m, repeated this afternoon at 4 p.m. Choral Evensong today, a live broadcast from St George's, Hanover Square, London, is on Radio 3 at 3 p.m. Loud. James Gallagher investigates the impact a loud world can have on a person's health. Loud is on Radio 4 at 3:30 p.m. Hancock's Half Hour, an episode of this timeless classic from 1956, is on Radio 4 Extra at 6:30 p.m. Radio 3 in Concert, a concert recorded on 29th of March in Manchester with works by de Roufflet, Chausson and Saint-Saëns. The concert can be heard on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. And then on Thursday, the 24th of April, In Our Time, Melvyn Bragg hosts a discussion on the playwright Molière, the 17th century great of French literature. In Our Time can be found on Radio 4 at 9 o'clock this morning. Strong message here. Armando Iannucci and Helen Lewis explore the use and abuse of political language, highlighting buzzwords, jargon, newspeak and verbal obfuscation in general. Strong message here is on Radio 4 at 9:30 a.m. Drama, All Change at Llanfair PG. A drama about a station announcer at the Welsh railway station with the longest name in the UK. All Change at Llanfair PG is on Radio 4 at 2:15 this afternoon. Parsley Sidings. Arthur Lowe and Ian Lavender star in this comedy episode from 1973 on Radio 4 Extra at 6:30 p.m. Radio 3 in Concert, a concert from the Glasgow City Hall with the Scottish Symphony Orchestra, a music programme featuring incredible women. The Radio 3 concert is at 7:30 p.m. And then finally, Friday the 25th of April, The Reunion, Pride and Prejudice, a repeat of Sunday's broadcast with Kirsty Wark on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. Punk, the Pistols and the Provinces. Mark Hodkinson looks at the impact that punk rock made beyond London, especially in Yorkshire, where the Sex Pistols played their first and last gigs. You can hear all about punk on Radio 4 Extra at 10:30 a.m, repeated at 4:30 p.m. Heart and Soul, a programme about sacred harp vocal music that took hold in the American South in the 19th century. Heart and Soul is on the BBC World Service at 11:30 a.m, repeated at 10:30 p.m. And then The Ken Dodd Show, an episode from 1967, is on Radio 4 Extra at 6:30 p.m. And then not forgetting, Friday night is Music Night with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, is on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m.
Now here's a nature note about the wren from Rupert Evershed.
Is it a mouse? No, it's a wren. The dry leaves at my feet rustled and a little brown shape flitted out of sight under a pile of leaves. Before I had time to decide what manner of mouse this was, the mouse hopped up through the tangled brambles and flicked its wings, issuing a loud, scolding stream of tuts before disappearing again. I was certain I had been watching a mouse, but no, this was the tiny wren, a feathered brown ball and one of the smallest British birds. Often assumed to be our smallest bird, the wren is pipped to the post by the goldcrest, a truly minuscule bird that keeps to the evergreen trees and shrubs of parks and gardens. As you would expect, the goldcrest's voice is needle-thin, its song a delicate cascade of squeaky notes. The wren, on the other hand, despite being only fractionally less tiny, punches well above its weight with one of the loudest songs of all our garden birds. Its cheerful explosion of musical notes can be heard at almost any time of the year throughout Britain. But at this time of year, when love is in the air, the wren is more likely to be seen perched up boldly atop some shrubbery in full song. It is a business-like song that matches the wren's busyness as it flits and forages in the undergrowth. A song to dispel any winter cobwebs and get us moving. However, in folklore, it is this very voice that got the wren into trouble. Its scolding warning is reputed to have given away St. Stephen's hiding place, leading ultimately to his stoning as the first Christian martyr. This sorry tale was reenacted, particularly in Ireland, every St. Stephen's Day, by young boys going on a wren hunt to capture wrens and kill them by stoning. The dead wrens would then take centre place in a parade recalling the bird's unwitting betrayal. Thankfully, this barbaric activity is no longer practised, and where the wren does appear in St. Stephen's Day celebrations, it is only as an effigy fixed to a pole. This harsh treatment of the wren stands in contrast to the usual veneration given it since earliest times. The Druids believed it to be a sacred bird, and a symbol of wisdom and divinity. Harming a wren, it was believed, could lead to harm for the person, in the form of a withered hand or curse. The Greeks declared the wren the king of birds after its fabled victory in a competition to determine the greatest of birds by seeing which bird could fly the highest. It was assumed the eagle had won the competition as it soared high above all the other birds, but hiding on its back, the tiny wren was declared the victor and crowned the king of birds. For such a small brown bird, the wren's fame throughout history is maybe surprising. But it is perhaps more familiarity than fame or any special feats that have made the wren both famous and infamous. Its scientific name, Troglodytes troglodytes, derived from troglodyte or cave dweller, hints that the wren has been with us from the earliest times wherever we dwell. Rarely a day goes by when I don't hear the song of the wren. It greets me as I enter the garden and accompanies me on almost any walk I do. Just last week, a small ball of brown whizzed past my head as I walked out of the back door into the garden. It appeared to disappear in the wall of the house, but on looking I could see a small opening by a pipe, this year's cave of choice for the little wren. That said, it may or may not see a brood of new wrens, as male wrens typically build anything up to 12 nests in a season. He must trust that one of them will meet with approval from his mate. If it does, the hen wren will complete his work with a lining and raise a large family of 8 or 9 young. If you have any thick ivy or shrubbery in your garden, the chances are you will have nesting wrens. In a few months' time, you may well see the newly fledged young sitting in a row, freshly spilled out of the nest and awaiting their next meal. Take a moment to appreciate these larger-than-life characters, for they are part of the assumed fabric of our lives, bringing a cheery and often noisy busyness that we'd miss if it wasn't there.
Well, that brings our spring magazine programme to a close. Thanks, as always, to Goffby for our theme tune, Briefly Encountered, and thank you very much for listening. Just a quick note that our next quarterly magazine will be posted to you in just 10 weeks' time, as Easter's really late this year. So could you please make sure to post back your memory stick by the beginning of June? That's really important for us to have them in stock ready for the next one, which is only 10 weeks away. So if you could post your memory stick back to us by the beginning of June, please. We hope very much that you'll be able to make most of the spring ahead, but it's goodbye for now.